This is a new experience for me. I've never before given a speech where the audience was asked in advance whether they wished to hear it. And certainly not with such a resounding veto-proof majority against. And I can only ask, Mr. Chairman, if you would do me a favor, and after I've finished, not hold another vote to see if the outcome is even worse. This all puts me in mind of a very great president of the University of California many years ago, Clark Kerr, who, as presidents sometimes are, was sacked by the regents under the direction of the governor at the time, a man by the name of Ronald Reagan. And when he came out of the meeting, he said, "I leave just as I arrived, fired with enthusiasm." I'm also a little bit in mind of a remark, and I'm sure you all know this, of the great humorist Will Rogers, who said, "I belong to no organized political party. I am a Democrat." And I am a Democrat. I'm an old Democrat. My work in presidential campaigns goes back to 1964, when I stuffed envelopes and made telephone calls for one Lyndon Johnson. It was a pretty good beginning. We shall not dwell on my record since. But it's worth, of course, remembering that there was a reason why Johnson did so well in 1964, which is that he led the Democratic Party from the state of Texas. And I, as I listen, Betty Moore, to your very moving invocation a few minutes ago, I have to say, and this will be my last partisan remark of the evening, that I was put in mind of a comment by a Republican president, Abraham Lincoln, who at the start of the Civil War said, or is reputed to have said, "I would like to have God on my side, but I must have Kentucky." And as a Democrat, that's how I feel about Texas. Very much your job. Well, you came or didn't come to hear a talk about economics, and I will, given the hour, probably not give you the full 2.5 hour disquisition that I had prepared. But I do want to say a few words about where we stand and the situation that we face. And there are a few words that will have a certain historical sweep to them. That's the way I've been thinking about the problem. We are passing now through the 5-year anniversary of Lehman Brothers, AIG, the renationalization of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and the TARP program. I was in Washington for a television program on all of this a few weeks ago, and everybody was talking in very somber tones. I said, "I am pleased to be here for this celebration." I think we ought to have a little conversation about why things have turned out as they have in the last 5 years, which is better than they could have, and to some degree worse than was expected. And I know you alluded to this in your remarks at the beginning, Mr. Chairman, I just want to take up that issue. Our economy has not yet recovered to where it was or to where many of us who have some historical memory of the good years have been conditioned to think of the normal state. And by the way, in the rest of the world, particularly in Europe, parts of Europe, things are markedly worse. And so we need to think a little bit about what's going on in the world. And I will argue that that will help us think about what's really important to politics and policy in the United States right now. 5 years ago, if you asked any so-called mainstream economist, that is to say, an economist with a good reputation as an economist, which is, someone came to me and said, "You're a great economist." I said, a few minutes ago, I said, "Well, that's damning with faint praise." It's the word economist. Great is okay, but the word economist is a problem. But 5 years ago, if you asked a mainstream economist what was happening, they talked in terms of a kind of great shock to the economic system, from which there would be eventually a full recovery. There was a moment when the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, Mr. Bernanke, said, "The economy will recover," flatly. He didn't say how he knew that. He was just stating a universal supposition. They had different views about what caused the shock to the system. Conservatives said, too much government intervention in the housing market. That is to say, too much effort to get low-income people into homes. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and all of that. Liberals, I think with considerably more evidence, said, this was greed, fraud, and corruption. That is to say, a banking sector and a mortgage sector gone out of control that poisoned the whole financial system. But both of those explanations have in common is that you have basically a healthy system with a big problem that interrupts its normal development. Let's say a cause, and then that implies a cure. And there were still other positions. I mean, you scratch the economics profession, you get all kinds of diverse and sometimes chaotic arguments and expressions like fat tails or black swans or bubbles. And I won't give you a disquisition on all of these things, but the kind of explanation which says that bad stuff occasionally happens and we don't know why. Right? In which case, once again, everything is going to be all right in due course. And if you look back at the forecasts that were being issued 5 years ago, by now we should have been back at 5% unemployment. We should have been back at something close to a balanced budget. We should have been back at a high rate of growth. And not just 5% unemployment with a low level of labor force involvement, but all the people who were unemployed in 2009 should have been back at work. And we know, of course, that's not the case. We know there are a lot of people, in addition to the unemployed, who've simply stopped looking for work. And they stopped looking for work for the very good reason they don't expect to find it. So we're in, it seems to me, a situation which is really quite different from what we as an economics profession, and I exempt myself from this, but what the overwhelming majority of economists were saying 5 years ago. And now we have, of course, people recognize this, and amongst the economists, the two sides each blame the other for messing things up. Have one side said we should have stimulated more, and the other side which says we should have stimulated less. It's not a very edifying dispute, and I think it misses another possibility. which is that from a larger point of view, affecting not only us, but in some ways the whole world, we're in a more difficult time. Let me just, I see there are a few people around here who remember the whole trajectory since World War II, so let me just try and summarize it for us. I think this will be not an unfamiliar story. I think it's reasonable to divide that period into the period since 1945 into two great separate periods. One of them was 1945 to 1970. In that period, a kind of golden age, post-war period, the whole world grew quite rapidly, rich countries, poor countries. And we especially enjoyed a strong, stable improvement in living standards with some interruptions. And we didn't really run into trouble in a serious way until the 1970s, and then we did. And in the 1970s, we had oil shocks, unemployment, and inflation. And then, I hate to say this, but along came Ronald Reagan. And the story is that Ronald Reagan fixed all that. Ronald Reagan fixed all that, and that Bill Clinton was just an afterthought. Okay. You see, I said I'm not making a partisan speech here. But I think this story is, in fact, very widely accepted. And I would argue that what happened in that second period, 1980 to 2000, was something quite different. The U.S., in fact, did all right. Rich countries did all right. But much of the rest of the world was left out of this. Right? Latin America, Africa, Eastern Europe, the former Soviet Union, all of them went way down in this period, and we benefited from that. So it was no longer a case of the world being able to grow together. It was a case of the rich countries being able to grow, but the poor countries not. A lot of system stress. And even that period, which looked pretty good from our point of view, comes to an end 13 years ago with the millennium in 2000. And again, I'm going to make a comment which is even almost a little bit sympathetic to the other party. I'm just doing this for show, mind you. It's really a rhetorical device. So you can perceive me as being fair-minded when you know that I'm not. But what happened when George W. Bush came in? He had a recession because of the collapse of the information technology boom, the stock market. And he tried every which way to defer the consequences. Number one, big tax cut for the wealthy, right? But gave them back some income that they'd lost in the stock market. Number two, the Iraq War, spent some money. Number three, in 2004, the Bush administration told the Congress to spend anything they wanted, got them through the election. Number four, and all through this period, the real estate bubble. And what was that? It was a tremendous effort to get loans out to people who couldn't repay them. Quite deliberately. There were a lot of people, if you could repay your loan, chances are you already had one. But if you could make loans to people who couldn't repay, you could make a lot of loans, book the origination fees, book the what's called the securitization fees, and the loan sits somewhere else, maybe in Germany, by the time it actually blows up. And the whole system, which had been built up since the New Deal, this is where I really, having been generous to the Bush administration, where I really believe that they contributed to the destruction of the system, a whole system that had been built up since the New Deal to create a homeowning middle class was torn down. So it seems to me that's where we stand now. 5 years ago, actually 6 years ago, in August of 2007, this began to unravel, and it unraveled in the most dramatic way in September, October of 2008. It's a way which gave us the election of Barack Obama. It was really quite remarkable what happened in that particular period when the Republican campaign just lost all credibility, and then Senator Obama showed that he could exercise real leadership in the country, which gave him the election and a lot of public confidence going in. But even a president elected with a lot of public support and support in Congress is not an all-powerful figure. And the conditions under which the Obama administration operates have been very difficult. The public is trying to get out of debt. So they're not taking on new debt, they're paying down old debt, they're spending a lot less. That's the first fact. It really is very difficult to change. You can give them more money, but it doesn't change the fact that they want to fix their balance sheets. Resources, which lie behind this, I think, in a very deep way, are fundamentally more expensive than they were in the 45 to 70 period, and for that matter, than they were in the 80 to 2000 period for us. Energy price about twice, but you can go and look. You can buy gas, it's $3.60, $3.80. It's not $2, it's not $1.80. Right? It's about twice what it was even just 10 years ago. Is that gonna change with shale? Big imponderable, but for the moment it's sitting there as a, I think, major, I would call it a kind of choke chain on growth. You get the economy going fast, energy prices go up, comes in your wallet through a spending program or a tax cut, goes out again through a gas bill. That's point number one. Second thing is we no longer control the world the way we once did or the way we imagined we did. Right? The world system that ended in 1970 hasn't been rebuilt, and for all the respect we owe to people who serve, they've been put in very difficult situations, and we've seen how difficult they are. And they know it better than anybody else because they've seen it. I've talked to the commanders. I talked to the commander who came from San Antonio, Ricardo Sanchez. A good man in a very, very difficult position. Right? So I think we know, and the world knows, it's not just that our power is more limited. All forms of power are more limited in the world today than they were in 1945 or 1970. It's just a fact. Third point has to do with these things. All these technologies. What's going on here? What's going on here, it seems to me, is that we're experiencing a set of changes which are designed to and effectively do reduce the amount of labor, the number of workers that companies need. Right? I mean, this is a small thing, and it's the functions of a computer, a typewriter, a telephone, your mail service. It's all right here. I was talking a few weeks ago to a friend of mine who works as an economist for Federal Express in Memphis. And he said, you know, our problem is the smartphone is so small that they don't need the same number of airplanes that we used to need to bring goods from Asia because you could pack more of them into a single plane. Right? Okay, it's not a bad thing, but it's not so good if you happen to be a pilot, right? Or a loader or an unloader. This is not the first time we've seen this. My father grew up on a farm in Canada. And, you know, he was born in 1908. His farm was powered by horses. In the 1920s and the 1930s, those horses got unemployed. This technology is doing roughly to the office worker what the internal combustion engine did to the horse. Right? Roughly. It's not a surprise. But it's something, and it's not something we can reverse, and it's something which, in fact, we can count on to be a benefit if we use it correctly, but it causes problems now. And the fourth thing that I would point to is the consequences of the financial meltdown. And here I do have a difference with the president and administration. I think if they cleaned up the banks, they would be in better shape now than they are. that's a judgment call. I have a lot of respect for Gene Sperling, Jack Lew, people who are working for the president. But I think they called it wrong on that. And the consequences is that you really can't, you have this enormous system of broken banks that are a huge dead weight on the economy. And they're not doing anything useful. When was the last time a bank made a loan? I mean, imagine that, to a business. It's community banks, yes, regional banks, yes, but the mega banks, they're into other things. They're into figuring out how to avoid taxes across countries. Other useful things if you happen to be a certain type of person, but I don't see any of those in this room. So what happens when the circumstances get tough? What happens is that the whole economic game becomes a lot more tense, and bad actors can do a lot more damage. And you see this with the foreclosures. The banks are out, and the servicers are out grabbing people's properties, sometimes when they don't even have mortgages on them. But in any event, with a lot of documentation irregularities, to put it in a gentle and compassionate way. You see this with an enormous industry which has cropped up in Washington to persuade you that we can't afford Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Right? And these are entities funded by a foundation named after and founded by a man who was the Commerce Secretary, the Secretary of Commerce in the administration of Richard Nixon, who was, as I believe most of you will remember, a Republican. It is part of a long tradition of animosity in high circles to these programs. Why? Partly because they work, and therefore they show that the government isn't entirely incompetent. Right? Something that we as Democrats know. Something everybody knows, but some part of the community wants to deny. And partly because these programs really do take business away, in some cases, from private insurers, who would like to have some of it. And from mutual fund managers, who would like to have the revenue stream from the payroll tax. And so there's some economic interest and some ideological interest, and it's targeted on the programs that were built up in the New Deal and the Great Society that still serve us very, very well. And then there's the attack on everything else in the government, which goes by the name of sequestration, and now the shutdown. An attempt, in some sense, to devalue and discredit, to make things not work, to make people forget, in some sense, all of the useful things that government does. I don't think it's working. I think actually at the moment people remember very vividly what the national parks were like. But wait, if it goes on, if it's allowed to go on, who knows how these things will develop. And then there is this program that you may have heard of. It's called the Affordable Care Act. Obamacare. And what's going on there? Obviously, a battle of extreme importance to somebody. Because at least ostensibly, they're closing the government over it. Because they cannot stand to have this take effect. Now, I have to tell you, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool member of the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party. And I was an Obamacare skeptic. Didn't have a public option, wasn't a single-payer system. I'm now thinking, there must be something powerfully good about this program. Right? And I think it must go beyond the fact that it enables people who don't have health insurance to get it. I think it does. I was reading the New York Times piece the other day. about how the Koch brothers and Ed Meese and Freedom Works and everybody's teamed up for a long time to fight this last-ditch battle. I'm going, why? I mean, the president was already reelected. He's not going to face another election. These people are rational. The president's a popular figure in the country. It doesn't make sense just to tarnish him personally, embarrass him personally. I mean, you can imagine it, but it doesn't compute as a strategy of rational politicians. But on the other hand, consider that most working Americans do, in fact, have health care, and they get it through their employers. And sometimes it's good, and sometimes it's not so good. But what happens if you have a pre-existing condition and you're working and you've got a health insurance? I'm seeing a nod over there. This is not a big secret. You are stuck in that job. And the president's program, the Affordable Care Act, unsticks you. And I can imagine a lot of employers, not the good ones, I'm not hearing this from General Electric, I'm not hearing this from Lloyd Blankfein of Goldman Sachs or Jeffrey Immelt. We're hearing this from another type of employer who have, I must say, some interest in this. They would like to have this particular lever over their workforce, and they see maybe it's going away. And I say, as Democrats, this is a very important issue. Just as the extension of Medicaid throughout the South and here in Texas is a very important issue. It's, of course, a piece of the Affordable Care proposition. Let me just quickly offer a general framework for thinking about why is it that the United States is doing better than parts of Europe? I think it's precisely because we do have, at this continental scale and this vast economy, these programs that were created in the New Deal and the Great Society and that continue to serve us all. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, the minimum wage. All of these things are around. If you're in Europe, if you're in Germany, you're fine. If you're in Greece or Ireland or Portugal or Spain, these things are gone. And that is a huge difference. That's a difference between having a shot at a job and not having one, having a job with a decent wage, being able to retire, not being able to retire, having to think about emigration if you are Portuguese or Greek or something, or not. It's a huge difference. We have assets, in other words, in this country, which are important to defend, and even to extend. I'm a big fan of raising the minimum wage, and by a lot. I think it would be very good for the country. I'd like to see Social Security made available on generous terms, the full benefit, to younger people for a while. Saying these are ideas Democrats should be thinking about. We should be thinking about our position, not about the other side's position all the time. Of course, it's important now that we're committed to the Affordable Care Act. Let's make it work. Let's get all the young, healthy people signed up for this thing. And then the premiums will stay down and the system will work. If they don't, they won't. But if they do, they will. Let's support our public schools and fight off voucherization, privatization. I noticed in the publicity for this event there was some talk about maybe having some public option banking. Well, I'm an old banking guy. Bank of North Dakota is a pretty good idea. It would serve a purpose and keep the big guys in line until they can be taken over and restructured, which we'll eventually have to do. So what's happening now? For 5 years, I know you love financial crisis. Everybody loves a good financial crisis. And we haven't had one for 5 years. And so now, we're getting another one, aren't we? We've already got the shutdown of the government, partial shutdown of the government, and we're getting a huge buildup to the default coming up on October 17th. Armageddon. I was driving down here from Austin, listening to this on the radio, listening to the speaker, Mr. Boehner, who, as I believe you know, is a Republican, talking about how terrible the shutdown is and how much worse default would be, and by God, he's against it, but he doesn't want to do anything that would stick the bill to our grandkids. He needs a negotiation and a compromise. And I'm sure in some political sense that's true. He needs it to keep his, save his face and keep his job, which is not my problem. And I detect that your sympathy for this is also somewhat under control. But what's going on here? I'm thinking, you know, somewhere I've seen this movie, I've heard this song before. And then I'm thinking, you know, 5 years ago, I was hearing this song about what we had to do to save the financial system. And what we're being told now we have to do to save the financial system is make some enormous sacrifice that's going to fall on us. Hasn't been specified yet, but we have, the 8th of October, so we have 9 days still to go. Plenty of time for it to be specified. And when it is specified, count me as unsurprised if it has Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Count me as unsurprised if that's what happens. That's what we're told we have to agree to in order to get past the default. I say it's important to maintain a skeptical attitude. Is this thing called default the financial Armageddon that every commentator informed by the economists from the financial community is saying? I actually read a Goldman Sachs paper on this morning, and when you read it carefully, you got the impression that these economists were pretty good, were being quite coy. They weren't saying this is for sure Armageddon. They say, well, maybe if foreign investors dump U.S. bonds, that will have a bad effect. True, unquestionably. The Chinese decide to sell off $2 trillion worth of U.S. bonds all at once. That would be bad. Are the Chinese going to do this? The probability is zero. I speak as a former advisor to the government of China. I know where I'm speaking. I have lots of little tendrils in all kinds of things. But I can tell you, the United States is not Argentina, which owed debt in a currency it had to earn with exports and could not pay. The bonds went away. They're going to be written down. It is not Greece, which owes debt in a currency it uses but does not control and cannot pay. And we are not Russia, which owed debt in its own currency in 1998 and defaulted because a lot of foreign investors had been dumb enough to buy the stuff and the Russian government decided to stiff them. Right? The government of the United States is not going to do any of those things. And everybody knows it. If you hold a U.S. government bond and the coupon, interest payment doesn't arrive on the 31st of October, which is the actual date that interest is due, you know very well that bond is going to be good as soon as they get their act together, and that you're going to get not only the interest you owed, but the additional interest. And that bond, I guarantee you, will continue. I can't guarantee, but I strongly suspect will continue to trade at very much its present price. Now, there are going to be some legal issues, but the notion that this is some fantastic event which requires us to make a major sacrifice of the programs that we know are working and to which we owe the stabilization and the relative success of our economy in the last 5 years is a major fallacy. And so I say that to you as a kind of, well, we'll see how this goes, but to alert you to the way I think things may unfold. I think we very much want to support our president and hope that the political strategy of simply getting the Republicans to back off works. The idea of coming to a last-minute compromise is not a good one, and we should discourage our leaders from doing that. Be skeptical. Stay calm. Don't panic. Keep your hands on your wallets and make sure everybody knows that those Social Security checks and those Medicare reimbursements and those Medicaid services and the other things on which our population has very much a fundamental part of what makes us into a functioning and successful national community, that those things are maintained and not sacrificed. Thank you very much indeed.